This is a literate congregation. I don't mean just that you know how to read, but you know a thing or two about literature and books. So do you mind a quiz? The top 10 first lines of American, well, not of American, but of literature. Top 10 first lines, are you ready? Number 10? Put it up there, Garth. It is universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Pride and Prejudice, right. Jane Austen, okay. Number 9. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Ooh, a little harder. 1984. Yeah. Number 8. It was a pleasure to burn. See, Kim knows, Fahrenheit 451. That's Bradbury, yeah. All right, number 7. I think all the junior high kids will know this one. Call me Ishmael. Some years, never mind how precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Moby Dick! Yeah, see, you guys. Number 6. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. Huh? That's C.S. Lewis. Oh. Number 5. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Dickens. Yeah, you know that one. Number 4. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. See, I mean, Kyle knew that one. Yeah, that's Tolstoy, right? Right. What are we? Number 3. All of this happened, more or less. A little more obscure. Slaughterhouse 5. That's Vonnegut. Yeah, it's kind of Vonnegut-y. You know. Number 2. It was a dark and stormy night. That's Snoopy. That's Charles Schulz did that one. Number 1. You better not never tell anybody but God. Huh? That's The Color Purple. Yeah. Thanks, Garth. Stories, books, literature, narratives of all kinds, novels, screenplays, campfire tales, maybe it's a play, maybe it's a bedtime story. Stories are this very human thing. It is this very human experience. It is an art. It is a craft that we share with you. Now, it's part of the medium of our relationships with each other. Stories amuse, right? Maybe if you have good stories, they do more than that. A good story will help you remember. Maybe a really good story will even make you think. But perhaps it's the best stories that actually change our lives. Luke's gospel is organized around what I would say is the best storyteller of all. Luke's gospel is organized around the best story of all. This particular storyteller would launch off. Two men went into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and one a tax collector. A little bit like two guys go into a bar. No. But who's the storyteller? How about this one? In a certain city, there was a judge who neither feared God nor had respect for people. In that city, there was a widow who kept coming to him. Who's this storyteller? There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, who feasted sumptuously every day, and at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, who was covered with sores. Huh? A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Who's the storyteller? Stories are powerful. Stories give shape to the world. Stories help us interpret human experience. They become the kind of lens through which we see things. We see ourselves, we see one another. Maybe even how we see God. Stories have power. Narratives have power. I think you would agree that contemporary public experience has made the case. Growing up, I really liked stories, especially the ones, maybe the ones on TV, but especially the stories that had a hero in it, right? Maybe that's because I, on some level, wanted always to be the hero. But I especially liked the ones that had kind of a tough hero. When Bonanza came on, click, man, I was right there. The Rifleman, later on when Clint Eastwood got to be a big shot. I loved it. These strong, quiet, self-assured, violent men, always men, by the way, these guys who would come and who would save the world. And the narrative always ran something like this, that the world had run amok, that there were just failed institutions and useless leaders and weak enforcers of the law. All there really were good guys and bad guys and maybe a few young, beautiful women in between who needed saving. That always seemed like how the world was, right? How it was organized. But what if it isn't? Stories have power. And if you can control the narrative, you can control the people. We behave accordingly. If you paint a picture of a world repeatedly and loudly, people start to assume as if that's the way it really was. You can tap into their inner parts, tap into their imagination. Narratives that describe the social order of things that make us see the stranger as the enemy, we start to think that way. Narratives that get painted for us that start to make us believe that our lives are in danger, we start to think that way. If I can paint a narrative in such a way to suggest that we need to put ourselves at the center of everything, it doesn't take long and we start to behave as if that were the case. Stories are always painting a reality. And if all those stories seem to be about fear, if all those stories seem to be about scarcity, if all those stories seem to be about anger or about hatred, that just makes us easy marks. That just makes us gullible. But all of a sudden, a different storyline appears, a contrasting narrative, a peculiar script that doesn't conform to expectations. There was a man who had two sons. Oh. Jesus tells a story about a family. Or is it about a family? Jesus tells a story about a dad and about sons and about a slave and about a calf. Well, I guess the calf doesn't last too long in the narrative, really. But it's a story about famine and feasting, one about going and staying, one about losing and finding, one about dying and living. Now, the story's not true, at least not in the sense of it being an actual description of actual events, right? It's not true that way. But is it true in another way? Is it true because we see ourselves in it? We have other untrue true stories, don't we? Paul Bunyan, Johnny Appleseed, Robin Hood. But Jesus' story catches us in a way that the others don't. Maybe you spotted somebody familiar in this story of Jesus, this tale of two brothers. The first time I read it, I thought, man, I got this one. I know exactly who that younger brother is. It's my younger brother. He gets everything he wants. He's always getting more than he deserves. Always getting favored treatment. Always getting congratulated for stuff he doesn't deserve. He's lazy and he's a lying son of a... Oh. Oh, wait. Then, of course, I realize there's another son in the story, too. Another son. Who is that? That privileged one. That one who's fussy. that one who seems to have this unrelenting sense of entitlement, this one who's always mad because, well, doesn't seem fair. And, oh yeah, then there's that father. What kind of a nut is he? Doesn't he know better? Getting hoodwinked like that? Come on, Dad! Don't you see what's going on? Hiking up his skirts, running, shaming himself? That's the kind of thing that gets you kicked out of the Rotary Club. And yet still he comes. Still he comes to these lost boys. Still he comes to these bad boys. Still he comes to these dead boys. This dad loves them both. Whiny and wild, reckless and ungrateful. This dad loves them both. This arrogant one, this selfish one, the wasteful one, the fussy one, the one with that sense of entitlement. By the way, did I mention him? Maybe the story isn't about the sons at all. Maybe the story is about the dad who moves first, the dad who doesn't wait. Maybe the story is about the dad who can't wait, about the dad who won't even let either of the boys finish their lines, but instead interrupts them with grace and love and with another chance. When I was in junior high, I decided to turn out for the baseball team. I think I told this story, but it's true. Little League was a big deal in our neighborhood, and all the boys were trying out. That's how you did it. You showed up at the field, and you got to play and practice, and you couldn't wear the whole uniform. They couldn't pass out the shirts, but you got the pants and the cleats. So you could kind of get the feel of the field and see how it would work. So the coaches would line us up and watched how we threw. Coaches would line us up and see how well we could catch. The coaches would line up and see how well we could hit and run and think. I looked around and I was not the biggest. And I was not the fastest. I couldn't hit it as far as some of the other boys. But I thought I had a chance. And we got to that one afternoon when they read the list. I waited and hoped and watched and listened. They had us lined up on home plate to first base, and they would just call out names, and they would go running for the dugout, and there were cheers and hats thrown into the air. I don't know what happened. He got to the P's, and I never heard my name. So I went home with my fancy baseball pants and my cleats. And I knew that I was supposed to take off my cleats at the front door before I went in. That was the rule at our house. But I went in and I sat on the couch and I put my cleats up on the coffee table and I turned on Gunsmoke. And I sat there all afternoon till my dad got home. And at first I went, oh crap, my cleats are on the coffee table. And he came in, and I don't know if Mom called him or what he knew or how he knew it, but he sat down next to me, and he took my cleated feet, and he put him in his lap. And I thought, man, I've had it now. And he untied them, and he pulled them off, and he peeled off those socks. Remember, I'm 12 years old, and I've been out on the field. Okay. And my dad just starts to talk to me and rub my feet. My 12-year-old feet. There was a man who had two sons. Amen.